You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in for Carrie Miller. Even before the pandemic, America's system for taking care of our oldest adults was understaffed and underfinanced. Thanks to the pandemic, worrisome signs point toward the economics of long-term care deteriorating even more. Nursing homes are the tragic epicenter of COVID-19. Residents are often frail, coping with several medical conditions and living in crowded facilities. The trauma from the pandemic extends beyond nursing homes to the wider ecosystem of senior living and senior care communities. COVID-19 has revealed what the long-term care community has long warned. America's elder care system fails to meet the needs and quality of life for too many of the country's older adults, especially lower-income elders. That said, the unprecedented disruption opens up the tantalizing prospect that society and policymakers will finally pursue reforms that would improve the living standards and lifestyle of older adults, again, especially lower-income adults. So to better understand the current situation, the dangers that lie ahead, and prospects for reform, I'm joined by two experts. Saria Robinson-Lane is an assistant professor of nursing and a gerontologist at the University of Michigan. Her expertise is in palliative and long-term care and nursing administration, and she joins us from Ann Arbor. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Robin Stone is co-director of the Leading Age LTSS Center at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. She is also senior vice president of research at Leading Age, a research and advocacy nonprofit. Glad you could join us.
Nice to be here.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have an aging parent or relative in a long-term care facility? What has been your experience during the pandemic? Do you manage an assisted living center? Tell us about the challenges you faced. Call us at 651-227-6000 or toll-free 800-242-2828. And Robin, I'll just start with you in terms of in terms of why has COVID-19 been so devastating for so many nursing home residents?
Well, I mean, it's not hard to figure out that you've got a lot of very, very sick people. Remember, nursing homes have two different kinds of tasks. They're taking care of long stay people who are very, very high acuity. Many of them also have significant dementia, a lot of comorbidities. And then you also have a post-acute care population that is more short-term, post-hospital, receiving a lot of rehab and also having complex medical needs. And so when you put all of those things together, the two populations living in very close quarters, sometimes everybody not having their own room and their own bathroom, having staff coming in and out of the building, including a lot of lower wage certified nursing assistants who are also very high risk for COVID, living in disadvantaged communities, coming in and out of the buildings, as well as other staff coming in and out of the buildings, like therapists and palliative care specialists and hospice folks. It has been a recipe for transmission and spread. And all of the nursing homes around the country have really been overwhelmed with this pandemic, which was not anticipated, not expected, and therefore a very significant crisis.
And Sheree, I imagine for a lot of families, this must be a very difficult decision to make. Do I put my elder into one of these facilities or remove them from these facilities and bring them home? I mean, that's got to be a very tough decision.
Well, it's always an incredibly challenging decision when you have to decide whether or not to place someone that you love into a facility. And the reality is, at the end of the day, individuals have to decide what sort of care needs their family members have and whether or not they're able to meet the demands of their care at home. And for individuals that end up in facilities, whether they're in nursing homes, assisted living, or other sorts of care facilities, they are able to receive the 24-hour nursing care and support for the management of their chronic diseases that the family can't easily manage at home, both chronic diseases, and keep in mind sometimes individuals go to long-term care sorts of institutions also for rehabilitation needs that require high touch and high contact that, again, the families may not be able to easily meet at home.
And Robin, so I know this is a complex, sprawling system, but very briefly, you know, how does long-term care get paid for in the U.S.? So Medicare, which is the, you know, the healthcare system for those 65 and older, does not pay for much long-term care, correct?
That is correct. Medicare pays for the healthcare, medical care of older people and certain people under the age of 65 who are disabled and qualify. It also pays for post-acute care. So the folks that come in from a hospital, they broke a hip or they had a heart attack and need cardiac rehab. Those types of folks will go into a skilled nursing facility for a short period of time, and that care is covered by Medicare. But these are folks who, by and large, are going to go home. The folks who are on the long stay side, the major payer for long stay nursing home is Medicaid. It has been since 1965. And actually, I would argue that the Medicaid program at its start really was the beginning of the modern nursing home in the United States. Medicaid is the major payer. In order to qualify for Medicaid, you actually have to be low income or you have to spend down all of your assets in order to qualify for being on Medicaid. And that has been the major public payer for nursing homes. Relatively few folks have long-term care insurance, private insurance that has not grown substantially at all over the past 30 years. In fact, many of those companies have folded. And so private insurance is not a major payer in this market. And the other folks who are able to pay out of pocket, remember that we're talking about on average $60,000 to $80,000 and even more per year. This is a very expensive endeavor if you were going to pay for it out of your own pocket.
And, you know, at the same time, Sharia, you know, the frontline workforce in these facilities, they're not paid much. And so you have this, you know, I think one of the puzzles that so many people have with our current system is it's largely unaffordable to, you know, middle income families, lower income families. And at the same time, yet the core workforce, they're not paid much at all.
No, they're not. Unfortunately, as a result of that, oftentimes, in addition to the low pay, many of these workers end up working incredibly long hours. Many of them work at multiple facilities, and so they're very tired. The health coverage, they may not be able to afford a significant health coverage, and so many of them suffer from their own medical issues in the midst of caring for other individuals. And keep in mind that more than 90% of these workers also are women who have other caregiving responsibilities of their own at home, whether they're caring for young children or caring for other aging family members themselves. When individuals have this caring skill set and what many will even refer to as a caregiving calling, then they find themselves also caring for members of their community in addition to their work-related responsibilities. And so it creates an incredible amount of stress for these workers.
So let me just give out the number again, because I want to hear your stories or your questions. I mean, do you have an aging parent or a relative in a nursing home? What has been your experience? Did you pull your parent or loved one from a facility as the coronavirus spread in the U.S.? And why? And how has that been going? Call us at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828. And let's go to Linda from St. Paul. Linda?
Hi. I'm probably not the only person to think of this, but my aunt was in a nursing home up until her death last year, And she was on Medicaid. She was unable to afford to have a private room. And most of these nursing homes are set up with two residents to a room, and they're arranged so that one bed is by the window. And the person who has that window bed has to pass right by the foot of the bed of the other person every time they use a bathroom or leave the room. And you can't really social distance in that setup. I'm wondering if this pandemic will bring an end to that setup of nursing homes where they have two people to a room and sharing a bathroom.
Sheree and Robin, I'd like both of you to respond to this. I'll start with you, Robin.
Well, I think you hit one of the problems on the head. As I said before, remember that nursing homes began in the 60s, and they were basically modeled after hospitals. So you had double-loaded corridors. You often had more than one person, even more than two people in a room. That has somewhat dissipated, and we're seeing more and more single rooms with single bathrooms. But I want to take us back to Medicaid reimbursement. One of the reasons that we do not have nursing homes all over the country that have all single rooms with bathrooms for each individual is that reimbursement rates are significantly low, and they vary tremendously across the states, and there are not enough resources in the system to support the kind of a physical environment that we would like to see for all older adults, and particularly lower income folks who are reliant on the Medicaid program for coverage. So this whole question of how we finance and support congregate environments, whether it's a nursing home or an affordable assisted living or other options, really has to, at its base, the systemic base is, what is the society willing to pay for?
Sheree, anything to add?
Yes, and I think the other thing that's important here is that the question is also specifically as it relates to COVID infection right now. And I think it's important for people to know that managing infections in facilities is something that long-term care facilities, nursing homes, have been doing for many, many years. And so they're well aware of the risks of having roommates, and a lot of thought goes into roommate selections, mm-hmm. both on personality, social needs, as well as what the medical needs are of the individuals in the room. And so what facilities are currently doing as it relates to COVID is being very thoughtful about roommate pairings and even doing selective isolation of units so that COVID patients are roomed on specific units within the nursing home. And some nursing homes that are part of chains, for example, are even having specifically designated COVID buildings where they're able to house individuals there. So nursing homes are definitely taking large measures to continue to keep people safe and to stop the spread of infection throughout the facility and certainly between roommates.
And let's go to Stina. I hope I pronounced your name right. Stina in Spring Grove.
Hello.
Hello. Is it Stina or
Hi.
Stina? Sorry.
Yeah, it's Stina. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank
it's
you.
It's a Norwegian name. Yeah, I am home right now in Spring Grove, Minnesota, and my grandfather actually, about 2 months ago, he required a little bit more care, so he was going to need 24-hour care, and my family was trying to decide whether or not to place him in a nursing home, but he has significant hearing issues, and it just worked out that he was able to move in actually with my family, and we've been able to take care of him because we were really worried with, you know, the coronavirus and everything, that if he was placed in a long-term facility, that we wouldn't be able to visit him. And he, like I said, has very significant hearing issues, and so even FaceTiming and calls and stuff, he really has a lot of trouble. So we decided to take him into our home.
And so, and is working for you and him?
Yes. Yep. It's been really wonderful. I'm actually a college student, and this summer I was supposed to be studying abroad, but I'm home helping on the farm, and so it's been really nice to be able to be back on the farm and to spend a lot of that quality one-on-one time with him.
So, well, that's wonderful, and I'm glad you are able to spend that quality time with him. And Robin, you know, one of the threads to pick out of this conversation is just the concern that Stina expressed about putting her grandparents into a nurse, into a facility, and maybe not being able to see them during quarantine. And then what Sharia was saying about, you know, what nursing homes are doing, it strikes me as this is, you translate that, it means less revenue, more expenses.
Yes. And I do want to respond to the last comment,
yeah,
because I think it's really important for all of our audiences to know that 80 to 95% of all the long-term care that is provided in this country is provided by families. So it isn't as though everybody is going into a nursing home.
Right. Yes.
The truth of the matter is that most people are doing exactly what was just described. They do everything. I have studied family caregiving since 1985, and the data over the years has never changed. Our families are the first line of defense for caring for older adults and other folks in the community. So that is the norm. So the vast majority of people are in the community, and you've got about 1.3 million folks who are in nursing homes. Actually, the occupancy has gone down over the past 10 to 20 years. Right now, in our long-stay facilities, you primarily have folks who have a lot of advanced dementia, conditions that cannot be managed in the home, and they also may be people who either live alone and have nobody else to care for them, or have family situations that are just not amenable to keeping somebody in the community. So I think it's important to understand that most of our long-term care is provided by families, and it is provided in the community, not in nursing homes. Having said that, I do think that this pandemic is going to have a significant effect on the resources and the financial stability of the nursing home and assisted living as well. And these congregate environments are important because not everybody can remain in the community. Not everybody has a student, like we just heard on the phone, who is excited and happy to have her grandfather living with the family. So I think it's really important for us to understand the dynamics of how people make their choices in long-term care, and what the role of congregate environments, particularly the nursing home and assisted living, play for people who can no longer remain in the community.
And let's go to Anna. Let's see, Anna in Spring Grove, also in Spring Grove. Anna?
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was a geriatric nurse for 25 years. It was my first love right out of nursing school. I've cared for elderly in home health, hospice, and in long-term care and rehab. I feel like this was a disaster waiting to happen. Norovirus, any of the viral illnesses, can go through a nursing home like that through a goose. It goes quickly. Norovirus can make them very ill, and of course it can make the staff ill. I truly feel that when the first cases broke out in Washington State at the nursing home there, they should have been locked down. More should have been done to screen people when the first outbreaks occurred in the nursing home in Washington State. I've always loved the care of the elderly, but I think they were sitting ducks. Mm-hmm. And I hope that this does something to change the way we care for them. Hopefully that we value age more in this country, because we don't. We kick them down to the curb like old tin cans. And that's not fair. We never have really in this country valued the wisdom of age. Other countries do, in Africa, in Europe. They value the wisdom of their elders, and we don't.
Yeah.
You know, if they can't be productive and can't make money, then they're not useful for anything. I agree with your guest that not everyone can afford, to stay home with their parents. We were lucky. We had money from an oil find that, so my parents were able to keep my mother at my, we were able to keep my mother at home with sitters.
Okay.
But not everyone can do that.
No.
But we could do a better job of socializing. The Eden Alternative, the Greenhouse Project, they've tried, Dr. Thomas has
right.
tried to change yep. the situation.
Yeah. So let's, Sharia.
Yes. So many important points that were
yeah, exactly.
raised here. I think
one of the first things to note is that when we first started seeing cases here in the States, remember, we didn't have a ton of information when coronavirus first arrived. We had some information, and much of our response collectively was based upon how we've been managing influenza. And so many of the things that the facilities did put into place were the same sorts of precautions, but we quickly found out that coronavirus was incredibly more contagious than any flu we've ever seen. And so any of the measures that would have been put into place based upon, like I said, the sorts of things that we would have done for influenza just wouldn't have been enough. And so there's many factors as to why we saw this incredible spread within facilities. And I think we've also seen this began to, slow down in facilities as well. They've been able to be flexible, adjust their approaches, and we're still going to see cases in facilities because older adults just have multiple risk factors in general that put them much more at risk for being able to effectively fight an infection. They've got changes in their skin. They have a diminished cough reflex. They have other chronic diseases like diabetes and heart disease that can affect their immune response. So there's just so many other things on top of developing an infection that can be problematic. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that while many individuals are able to care for their loved ones at home, oftentimes there still comes a point where care becomes too challenging for individuals, and then at that point they either require additional care in the home by using home care services, or it becomes necessary to move them into a more supportive environment, either an assisted living or a nursing home environment. Even my own grandmother, who had Alzheimer's dementia, we were able to care for her at home through collective family care until she was about 92 or 93 years old, until we finally had to move her to an assisted living and then nursing home related to advancement of her dementia and increase in care needs that we weren't able to effectively meet at home.
And Robin, there was a lot that Anna raised, but yeah, one of the things that you know, I really struck me is there has been this callousness about the old during this period of time. You know, they lived a good life. Yeah. You know, okay, they're old. Why should I get upset about this? I mean, and I don't think I'm doing much exaggeration there. So it's very disturbing.
Yes, it is disturbing. As somebody who has spent my entire career in aging, I was 25 years old when I started working in my first area agency on aging, and I am now 70 years old. And so we're talking about a very long life of working in this sector on the policy side, as well as now for the past 20 years working at a provider association. I think it really speaks to the undervaluing of older adults, and in the case of long-term care, the undervaluing of the staff as well. So you've sort of got this double whammy of having marginalized older adults, particularly very elderly, sick and vulnerable folks who are in a nursing home or another congregate environment, being cared for primarily, and remember, 60 to 80% of all the hands-on care in nursing homes and in other settings is done by frontline aides, who they themselves are often vulnerable and disadvantaged. So you've got this double whammy situation, and I wanted to just add to that the comment that I make frequently. I'm trained in public health. That's my doctorate is in public health. I think this has been a horrific failure of the public health system and an investment in the public health system to actually do what was suggested, which is when we first saw those cases in Washington State, we should have been on that immediately. We should have been testing and contact tracing and isolating all of the nursing homes and other congregate environments around the country. We know where they are. We could have been doing a much better job if we had had good leadership around this and figured out how we judiciously use resources. There is no way that a nursing home in and of itself could have handled this type of pandemic. So it really sort of underscores and shows the underbelly of a system that has not been invested in. Both the public health system and the long-term care systems have been significantly undervalued in this country.
So Hess, we have some more callers on the line that I want to get to, and I really want to pick up on some of these threads that Saria and Robin have raised. But first, this is a good time to take a break. If you're just joining us, I'm Chris Farrell, in the day for Carrie Miller. Our topic is long-term care for aging Americans. My guests are Saria Robinson Lane, assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Nursing, and Robin Stone, co-director of the Leading Age LTSS Center at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. And we want to hear from you. What has been your experience with aging parents or relatives during the pandemic? The number is 651-227-6000, toll-free, 800-242-2828. And I want to start out with a comment that came in during the break, and it's from Doris in Mankato. And she writes, I am in good health, but I'm close to 90. I'm in a long-term care facility. My concerns is the staff is tremendous as far as protecting us, but they are not paid what they deserve. We praise them and give them so much credit for what they are doing, but I hate to see them not making what they are worth. And Saria, this strikes me as the core of one of the issues that we're talking about when it's about reform and better care.
Absolutely. And I think Robin spoke at length about this earlier, that really it comes down to the reimbursement that facilities receive that allows them to be able to pay individuals more of what they're worth and how they're valued, both by the residents that live in these facilities as well as the families that are thankful to them for being able to treat their loved ones as their own family members while they're in these care facilities. And so there's so many different layers engaged in payment. Many facilities that may not, there's large variances in what the pay rates are, of course, across the country and in different regions. And some of the things that facilities do where the wages aren't maybe where they would be most desirable are doing things like being able to provide meals to the nursing assistants and other staff, either completely free of charge or incredibly at a very, very low cost to make that less of a burden, making health services and supplementary sorts of services available right at work, like being able to see a medical provider to manage health needs, like having some sort of an occupational health sort of service available, as well as different sorts of employee health initiatives in order to support people in various different ways. And they've been even stepping up to provide additional care during this particular time of the pandemic of providing rooming for individuals who are concerned about taking the, becoming infected or taking the virus back home, providing rooms to individuals to help them in that regard, as well as making sure that their other needs are met so that they can effectively provide care and take off some of this burden from them.
And Robin, Howard Gleckman of the Urban Institute, you know Howard. And
yes, I do.
Yeah. In a recent writing, he said, think of the $13 plus median wage of a facility-based certified nursing assistant to the median nearly $17 an hour wage of vet technicians. And he said the economic message is our society values those who care for our cats far more than it values those who care for our mothers.
Yeah, I mean, this is an issue that is very, very close to my heart as well as to my career. I've spent quite a bit of time on the frontline workforce in long-term care across the entire spectrum. Actually, home care aides are paid even less than nursing home assistants. I think this is a significant systemic problem. Many nursing homes, many home care agencies go beyond the pale to really try to help and support their staff. But as a society, we do not value these jobs as we do not value our elders. And consequently, these folks are often classified as low-wage workers, which I think is the beginning of the end for them. These are highly professional, skilled caregivers. Leading Age has done a full competency battery for CNAs. And when you take a look at the kinds of things that they do and what they could be doing if they were allowed to do that, and that can get us into a whole other discussion someday, but the potential for these frontline jobs to be, first of all, valued, secondly, identified as a profession, and not just a job that is taken, but a profession that actually has career paths and career lattices and has the opportunity for growth. If we valued this workforce, we would have a very, very different system. I think reimbursement is a serious part of the problem, but I think it starts with the fact that we undervalue these positions. We require 75 hours of training for a CNA, which is less than we require for most people who actually work in cutting dog hair. And we actually don't pay much attention to the competencies that are required in these jobs. Aides are not considered part of a significant team in many nursing homes and many home care agencies, and yet they are the front line. They observe changes in condition way before any other of the clinicians will see anything going on. So I think we have to rethink what these occupations are, just as we begin to see the growth in the elderly population. Remember, over the next 10 to 15 years, we're going to be 1 in 5 elderly. This is just the beginning. And maybe the pandemic is going to teach us some things in terms of how we think about various parts of the continuum and how we develop and sustain a workforce that is quality and that is valued and that is compensated for the work that they do.
Yeah, low wage does not mean low skill. I think that should be a mantra that is out there.
I don't even use the term low wage worker because it is such a demeaning term. These are professional caregivers who are doing these jobs.
Give us a call at 651-227-6000 or toll free 800-242-2828 if you have a question for Sharia or Robin. And let's go to Jennifer in Minneapolis. Jennifer?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. I worked part-time in a low-income nursing home in a non-nursing aid role, and I quit late March when there was COVID-19 death, and I was not informed by my boss by the death. I heard it through rumor, and I reported it then to corporate asking why wasn't I provided a face mask, why wasn't I informed, and they were not aware of the COVID-19 death. I've also witnessed other incidents at this nursing home that were not reported, falls, someone that had left the nursing home that was in one of the lockup units and was found out in the cold when it was I don't know, 10 below. Anyway, my question is there a benefit for-profit nursing homes to not report incidences, including covering up COVID-19, spread infections, or any other kind of incidents?
Yeah. Thank you for that question, Sharia.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to note that the information that may be shared within the facility and what is shared amongst, like, the nursing staff and as part of the administration may not always be the same information that's shared amongst non-nursing staff for a variety of reasons. But in the short answer to the question is no, there's no incentive for not taking precautions to keep people safe and to provide high quality of care. In fact, there are significant consequences for facilities that put residents at risk due to safety issues and to a lack of reporting up to and including not being able to accept future residents, being denied payment from both Medicare and Medicaid, as well as facility closure if there's, you know, significant widespread issues that are consistent, not being able to resolve and that sort of thing. Facilities are regulated by both the federal and state government agencies, and they can and have shut facilities down for not providing adequate and appropriate care, and that includes COVID-related care.
Let's go to Suzanne in Decorah, Iowa.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a situation where both of my parents are in the same nursing home here in town, which is a wonderful care facility. I want that to be understood very clearly.
Okay.
My family has been so pleased with the care they've received. It's a small nursing home, all on one level, one floor. They have different wings, and one is a Alzheimer's or memory care unit, and that is where my mom is. It's a locked ward, and the other one is where my father is. There's another wing where he is helped with his physical needs, but his mind is completely clear. They've been married 75 years, and they are being kept apart in terms of during this COVID epidemic, they have not been allowed to see each other. My dad was going in to see mom in the locked portion every day and spend a couple hours with her prior to the epidemic or the pandemic. And now that has stopped. They have had no COVID in the facility, thankfully. But my question is there rationale for this in terms of prevention of the spread of the virus? And if there is, what it is? What is it? And is this logical? It is so heartbreaking as a family to watch them have to be kept apart.
Well, what a heartbreaking story. And married for 75 years.
Yeah.
No, Robin.
Yeah, this is the worst part of it all, I think, which is the human side of this and the human stories. I'm not a clinician, but I've certainly learned a heck of a lot about COVID and infection control. And I think the rationale behind this is the issue that we don't know who has COVID and who does not. We do not do universal testing and contact tracing of every single individual multiple times. If you think about the potential for one COVID case spreading through the nursing home, if someone were to come in and one of your parents were to somehow pick this up and the other were to become infected. So this is part of the prevention protocol. What I would suggest, however, is that we see many organizations that are trying to be creative in terms of how spouses communicate with each other, even within the same facility. I don't know whether your mother has a dementia that is advanced far enough that she could not communicate at all with some type of a tablet, if she were even to FaceTime with your father. But many, many organizations are trying to be creative with technological devices to at least get spouses to be able to communicate in some way with each other. Sometimes it may be an aid that actually communicates between the spouses. But there's no good, easy answer for this. All I would say is this is the protocol that is required around COVID, and you should be happy that your parents are in an organization that is paying attention to this.
In Syria, this is, you know, this is its own story, and it has its own, you know, heartbreak. But there have been so many families haven't been able to see their loved ones in these facilities during this period of time. You know, loneliness has, and isolation has become a huge issue.
Yeah, it's very challenging for family members. I mean, think it's challenging for all of us. And so think of the large extent to which older adults are experiencing even more social isolation, even within facilities, by, you know, some having to be limited to their rooms or, as mentioned, you know, not being able to go through the facilities or visit other relatives in the facilities. And so some of the things that can really continue to make a large difference are continuing with phone calls to loved ones. Many residents, the vast majority, tend to have either a phone in their room or have access to a phone so that you can call and speak to them. Going back to the age-old art of letter writing and sending cards and pictures and those sorts of exchanges with loved ones really makes a great difference.
And then also continuing to build relationships, as Robin sort of mentioned, with the staff and getting staff more engaged in care to help to facilitate some of these technology issues. We know that not every facility is going to have the capability of being able to provide, for example, iPads for resident use, but this is an opportunity for, you know, really our communities to come together to really use what resources we do have available to us to be able to help to facilitate and maintain some of these really, really important family connections amongst individuals.
Now let's go to Sharon in Minneapolis. Sharon?
Hi, thank you. I want to continue that conversation about both from the perspective as a daughter of a, my mom's got advanced dementia. She's in a great facility, and I'm a hospice chaplain. And what I'm seeing with people who are in hospice is that they are, hospice is about comfort care for people who, you know, physical, social, and spiritual. So keeping people safe physically, but who are actually dying longer, but now they're dying shorter because of COVID, but also because of the isolation, as you talked about, and the loneliness. These are people that all the virtual stuff that you're talking about doesn't work. The window visits don't work. The phone calls don't work. The tablets don't work. The letter writing don't work. If we in Minnesota have a preponderance of people who are impacted, dying actually from COVID right now, I think we should put the resources and attention to figuring out collaborative and creative strategies, more hospice homes. People could take wings of a nursing home and put that in for these people. Some people don't want to take a risk. Some people say, yes, it's good that your parents are in a place where they're physically safe. Most of me doesn't care. I'm not afraid of dying. My mom would be ready to die, but she wants me there. And so, look, it's spring outside. We can't even go sit and outside with masks. The people making these guidelines are not doing something that makes sense.
Robin?
Yeah, I hear you. And I think the hospice piece in particular, I do know that there is variation across the states in terms of what can happen around compassionate visiting. In situations of hospice or end of life. I do think we need to sort of think about and have some, at least some lessons learned around the fact that a one size fits all is not appropriate in these situations. I'm not sure I have an answer for you other than, as I said, we have seen variation across the states in terms of compassionate visitation at end of life and sort of trying to figure out what are the strategies around this. And I love your idea of co-locating hospice so that at least you have you can have a community that can be sharing at the end of life. It is not all about safety. But remember, the safety is not just for the people living there. It's also for the staff. And so the issues are, as you know, as being a hospice chaplain, are extremely complicated. But I agree with you that this is a human issue. It is not just a scientific issue, and it is not just a regulatory issue. And how we wrap our hands around this, I think, is really serious as we learn from this pandemic going forward.
And I would like to add that, of course, there definitely is going to be variance, but in talking with many infection control nurses across the country, one of the things that seems to be fairly consistent is that individuals who are at end of life, whether they are formally enrolled in a hospice program or they're just, you know, someone that isn't on a formal hospice program but effectively is dying, if they're actively dying, generally the facilities have been allowing up to two visitors to, attend to that person and to be able to sit and be with them during that period of active dying. But and so there's some discussion around, like, what that looks like at various facilities and how to make that happen. But I will say that there's ongoing discussion about particularly end-of-life care and how to provide this, and the facilities are really trying to work to find more ways to make make sure that people have, you know, what we would call a good death, in which they feel surrounded by comfort and love and attention, and that they have their symptoms adequately managed. We also know at end of life that the last of our senses to go is hearing. And so even though there may not be interaction that takes place via technology, individuals still have the opportunity, for example, to be able to speak to their loved ones, you know, using technology, like whether it be a phone or an iPad or a sort of device to still speak to them. In many instances, they can still hear them, as well as using devices like radios, so that people can still listen to music or listen to podcasts, or, you know, still be have some sort of engagement with the outside world.
Yeah, some kind of a still some kind of connection. And yeah, I mean, one of the things that I'm hearing from both of you is we really do need to look back on this experience and learn from it. And there's because there's so much variance, which is kind of frustrating, I think, for a lot of people. But at the same time, that does mean different states have handled things differently. So we can at least sort of say, well, what was the best, or what was the best practice? It's, well, let's go to MJ in Minneapolis. MJ?
Hi there. Two things I'd like to comment about. One, my parents both lived to their late 90s, and my father was in long-term care for 3 years, and my mother for 8 months, and then passed away at a local hospice. I'm very grateful that they passed away pre-COVID. But one of the things I observed in their long-term care situations is, as you've referenced before, the pay is not comparable to what the people are doing. And the other thing that we need to address as a culture is the number of immigrants serving in the long-term care community. That's a situation that's not appreciated by the wider population. And secondly, relative to COVID, as a boomer, I'm trying to delay as long as possible moving into any long-term care type of facility, because it's not something I'm looking for. None of us are looking forward to it. But I think this has taught us that the longer we can stay well and independent, the better off we'll be.
Yes, and the, very much so. And Robin, the immigrant workforce, is really important.
Yes, it is. I mean, immigration has been a pipeline for us forever. About a quarter, one in four, nationally, one in four CNAs are immigrants. One in three home care aides are immigrants. These foreign-born folks actually, the research shows that they actually have some better outcomes than native-born peers often. They tend to come from countries where older adults are valued more, and so there is a culture of really caring and understanding and respecting the older adult. We also see some evidence that their turnover rates are lower. So I think these are really important parts of our system. And quite honestly, they're going to be part of the pipeline for the foreseeing future. So we have to recognize the importance of immigration policy and what would happen if we actually shut down the availability of people to come into this country. This would be a serious, serious challenge for the entire long-term care continuum.
And I want to squeeze in one more call. Elon in Minneapolis, very quickly, please.
Hi. So I've been aging for 25 years. I was a nurse aide in the nursing home where my grandfather lived. And I think that a lot of what we're seeing across the country with COVID-19 death in long-term care settings, it's not so much about the caring, loving, dedicated, hardworking Medicare staff members. It's about a lot of the lack of support and training that they receive. We know that 70% of nursing homes in America are for-profit, roughly, and many more in assisted living. Half of nursing homes in America are understaffed, and one quarter are dangerously understaffed. Infection control through the roof for years, one of the top citations across the country. And we haven't talked enough about assisted living, the fastest-growing residential care option for older adults, with 7 out of 10 residents with cognitive impairment and assisted and activities of daily living needs, bathing and toileting, et cetera. Yep. We've had 20 years of warning signs, GAO reports.
Okay. I had to cut you off there, and it's the final note, because I'm going to – well, we've pretty much run out of time. And I really like to thank Robin and Sharia. This has been wonderful. Sharia Robinson Lane is a gerontologist and assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Nursing. Robin Stone is senior vice president of research at Leading Age.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.